All right. Welcome to the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace teleconference with Ted Malik. This is September 9th, 2012, and today we're talking with Ted about his work on practical wisdom for the workplace. And I want to let you know that this call is being recorded, and I will mute the call during the time of the interview. Actually, we're probably a small enough group. I don't need to do that. But if we start to hear background noise, then I'll mute it except for Ted and I. If you have any background noise on your phone, you can hit *6 to mute. And then when we open up the call for dialogue with Ted, then we'd ask that you say your name first. And I like to begin these calls with an opening reflection and a moment of silence. And I'm going to do... read a paragraph from what Ted submitted in terms of his topic for the keynote speech at the Wisdom at Work conference. And he'll be talking about practical wisdom in the workplace. So Ted writes, "The pursuit of knowledge and wisdom may be seen as bestowing divine purpose and meaning on the human condition. And it may be the ultimate driving force of all human endeavors. But since the progress of industrialization and modernity, only reason and knowledge are hailed as the guarantees for human advancement. So what can wisdom traditions offer to modern times? The most valuable thing they have to offer is the spiritual wisdom, which is at the inner core of all religions, and which recognizes divine revelation and human interconnectedness beyond doctrine and dogma. Religious traditions also offer a wealth of practical wisdom through the proverbs, tales, and parables in the holy books and beyond, in the teachings on individual and social responsibility, on the relationship of the material and the immaterial in the economy, in the oral traditions on how humans shape the world by the spirit they project on it." So please join me in a moment of silence. Thank you very much. Thank you. And I'd like to introduce Ted Malik, Theodore Roosevelt Malik, who serves as a research professor for the Spiritual Capital Initiative at Yale University and also a CEO of Global Fiduciary Governance, LLC. He's also managing director of the Americas of the Academy of Business and Society, and we'll be talking about that in just a little while. His most recent books concern the nature of spiritual enterprise, the practice of virtuous business, and the pursuit of happiness and the virtue of thrift. A couple of those books are particularly relevant to our Wisdom at Work conference, one of them called Spiritual Enterprise, Doing Virtuous Business. And Ted was here 2 years ago and sharing the video that was made out of that for PBS, Doing Virtuous Business, and a panel talking with actually a couple of panels in our Northwest Arkansas area that were promoting the business leaders who were involved in examples of virtuous business. And then Ted's newest book with Nick Capaldi is America's Spiritual Capital. Ted has served on the executive board of the World Economic Forum and has held an ambassadorial level position at the United Nations in Geneva and has sat on a number of corporate mutual fund and not-for-profit boards, including the University of Toronto International Governing Council, a Pew Charitable Trust Board, and the Templeton Foundation. Ted earned his PhD in international political economy from the University of Toronto and took his BA from Gordon College and an MLit from the University of Aberdeen. Now, I've known Ted for several years, and he's really a pioneer in communicating about the value of spiritual wisdom in the workplace. He's been a champion of this idea of spiritual capital, and he's been studying the connection between virtuous organizations and competitive performance for some time. Ted, it's really an honor to have you here with us today. Thank you so much.
Well, it's always good to be in conversation with you, Judy. I know that we're in many of the same places and often thinking similar thoughts, so to be part of this conference is really a great honor.
Oh, we're really delighted. You're going to bring an awful lot of depth and practical examples and inspiration to us. So I'd like to start with asking you, how did you get interested in this topic of practical wisdom? And what does that mean to you? Why the words practical wisdom?
Well, my interest goes back probably as far as my teenage years when I was trying to read very broadly, and I was brought up in the great books tradition as well as in religious traditions. But nevertheless, you know, I come from a family that worked for a living, so we were always struggling with these tensions and paradoxes in life about what you think and what you do, how you act, and what meaning and what bearing, particularly religious faith or philosophical orientation, has on how you live in the world. So whether that has to do with vocation, which is, of course, a key term, or calling, which is an even more traditional one, it really does all come back down to this question of practical wisdom, which really is a jewel of a term, because the words actually exist in almost all of the world's great religious and spiritual traditions. So it's something that they have in common, although there are wide differences. It's something that is rather important to our being in the world.
Now, is there something about either your father in the workplace or your mother in the workplace that's kind of an exemplary story that has inspired you from the way that they were in living their own practical wisdom?
I think there are always, you know, family examples and neighborly examples, and in my case, many mentors from school, which I was addicted to, and of course went on to different levels of education.
You're still addicted to it.
I wrote a book earlier with another author called Perpetual Learning, so I guess I live that, because I think the day we stop learning is the day we really stop living. But I also don't believe, while I have many degrees, that there's such a thing as a terminal degree. So the exciting thing about living is really that we do continue to learn, and practical wisdom has that same kind of notion that we fall back on the wisdom of times, and also on new knowledge, which is being constantly created, particularly in the technological world of modernity in which we live. But there's a practicality about that as well. I think if you want a psychological theory or hook to hang this on, I think of my father, who's deceased now, but who was a very great man and a very thoughtful human being. But he had two sons. I was the older, and he dragged us, I use that word literally, to the Philadelphia library, the Free Library of Philadelphia, every Saturday morning, at least as I recall as a youth, and we had to pick up three or four books, in my case, almost always biographies, and read them before the next week.
Wow.
When we got three or four more new books. Mm-hmm. So that voracious appetite for reading and learning, I think, I guess I could say, habituated very early.
What a gift he gave you. Yeah. Oh, great. Thank you. Now, when I introduced you, one of the roles I mentioned of your many is the title Managing Director for the Americas, and that's of the Academy of Business and Society. And thanks to your connection, the Academy of Business and Society is now a co-sponsor of the Wisdom at Work Conference, and as a part of that, the Sam M. Walton College of Business here at the University of Arkansas is a university partner of EABIS.
And this is a very good fact, and you know, realization of our ambitions down the years. So the collaboration on this, I think, is good and powerful. EABIS, it started 11 years ago now as EABIS, and it was the European Academy of Business and Society. And it started with five corporate members, IBM, Unilever, Shell, I mean, companies of really great and significant importance in terms of scope and style and relations, and a handful of mostly European business schools. In the ensuing decade, it has enlarged itself and stretched around the world. It recently, in the last 2 years, merged with the Asian Academy of Business and Society, and now it's working in the Americas where I'm working with them. So it is a global organization with about 200 members, 30 or 40 major corporations, and the others, all significant business schools who are really thinking about these new paradigms, particularly around issues of how business operates in society. So that would include such things as business ethics, corporate governance, sustainability, and then our little pearl, practical wisdom, mm-hmm. which comes down to us through the spiritual traditions and why we're so interested in the work you do, Judy, at the Tyson Center.
So talk about what you have been doing with Practical Wisdom, the series of conferences and the case studies and,
yes.
You know, just amazing.
And we have about 2 days to talk about that, I hope. No.
Yeah, we do. They're in October.
So let me just give you the context, first of all. In ancient Greece, you'll recall that Menoes, Socrates, can virtue be taught? And around the same time, Confucius was teaching these key virtues for leadership in China. And today, now 2,500 or more years later, in the field of management development, we ask a similar question. And I hear it repeatedly in so many corporations where I live and have lived over the last couple of decades. Can managers, and particularly can CEOs, learn to be wise? So in the Greek and Aristotelian traditions, which many of us know, practical wisdom is the mother of all virtues. But that view is not unique to that tradition, and indeed I think it's central to all spiritual traditions. And that's what the Abbas Yale Practical Wisdom Initiative, this conference series and publication, looks at. We're looking at the practical virtues that are inherent in managerial decision-making, which lead to wise decisions in, first of all, strategy, strategic management, in leadership, in human resource management, you know, in every facet, if you will, of current modern-day management. And this way, we can avoid, we think, the constraints imposed on the debate and reflection by an externally conceived, normative, arbitrary, say, list of relative principles or virtues. We're trying to take an approach that would look at and take into account the consequences, first of all, of globalization, which is a fact, and then the belief that a global market economy, which is what we have, needs, this is so obvious to us because it's missing in so many elements, an ethical framing and a moral compass to be viable, to be sustainable, to be equitable. And the emergence of that kind of world ethic has been called for, you know, by any number of actors, by any number of organizations, by, you know, some other initiatives that are looking at, you know, to create that kind of global ethic, but it's been found difficult. And I think that projects, frankly, in secular world ethics, and I've been familiar with a number of them down, you know, through the decades, encounter these difficulties because they're often disconnected from the deep-rooted spiritual and philosophical traditions, and in fact, then their cultural context.
They're more like an intellectual exercise.
They're not bad exercises any more than, you know, speaking Esperanto was a bad exercise, but it didn't amount to much, did it? Uh-huh. So these secular projects, I don't think they start from these deep roots, and therefore they're at risk of remaining, frankly, superficial and ultimately unconnected or meaningless. So those of us who are undertaking this project, and the project's now 2 years old, want to reconnect these spiritual traditions, not in some dogmatic sense, but we want to reconnect them to the contribution of a global ethic. And it's precisely, we think, this notion of practical wisdom, which is so missing. The world is so full of crises, of economical and financial debacles, of Ponzi schemes and every kind of economic vice, that we need this kind, I would call it, of platform for discovering a common ground between the traditions. But we start by looking at each of these distinctive traditions in their own right, at least the six major ones. That's where we have gone. And we've reached out to them in very, very serious global context then. The Practical Wisdom Project, I would say, embraces modernity, if it does so critically. I mean, it's a modern project. This is not like we're going back to the ancient texts and trying to be fanatical or dogmatic or fundamentalist about it. We view business and management as forces for common good. So we're not anti-business or anti-globalization. And we hold firmly to the belief that commerce and free trade make central contributions, potentially, to both world peace and to global stability. And in fact, the world is not only a better place, but it needs to have that as a common basis. So we're trying to work at this to construct a bridge. I like the word bridge. I know you've used it yourself. Between the worlds of management and the spiritual and philosophical traditions on a basis of mutual appreciation instead of mutual suspicion.
Yeah, that's what I call the Edgewalker path.
I
yeah,
know.
Walking between the worlds and building that bridge.
Well, we're doing that on a global basis, and, well, no one has put a fatwa out on us yet. And we've had five, now the sixth conference is coming up, but we've had five conferences where we have brought together in each theater 50, 100 leading practitioners, by that I mean real business people, usually very senior ones, with the top academics from these traditions to have a conversation. These conversations, frankly, have not happened, at least recently, and certainly not at this level or in this kind of context. So the first meeting took place at the leading Catholic university in Europe, Eichstätt, which is in Germany. And we brought together Protestants and mostly Roman Catholics for that conversation on Christianity. The second one looked at various Chinese traditions, but prominent amongst them, Confucianism and Neo-Confucianism, which is gaining real strength in Asia. And we held that at Siebes, which is, of course, a great business school in Shanghai. The third conference was held in Israel on Judaism. It was funded as well by the Mandel Foundation. It took place at Ben-Gurion University and also in Jerusalem. And we looked at the ancient roots of that, you know, fabulous monotheistic tradition. And we had some great practitioners at that conference. The fourth conference took place just about 9 months ago in India at one of their IIM, Indian Institutes of Management, the one in Kerala, beautiful place on the coast of India. And we looked at Indian traditions, but again, prominent amongst them, Hinduism, which is dominant in India, but also the Parsi traditions of Zoroastrianism. And then we had a conference just last January in Morocco at the King's University iFrame on Islam, which brought together actors from all over the Middle East and North America, Britain as well, to talk about this very powerful force, Islam, in the world, and how it could be structured for good, and how it has real implications for practical wisdom in business. The last of the conferences, of the six, is scheduled for this November. It will take place in Thailand at Thammasat University, and it will focus on Buddhist economics and management principles. So that's forthcoming. At the end of these six conferences, we're going to have a culminating event at Yale in New Haven, Connecticut, next June, the beginning of June, which will provide some kind of synthesis as well as a kind of bookend to the conversation to bring all these actors together and to try to have a deep, deep, deep conversation. So that's the project in a nutshell.
Thank you. And out of that is also some kind of book or journal articles or case studies?
Yes, well, we invited the Journal of Management Development, which is an A-rated top journal with about a 60,000 circulation in management that a lot of practitioners read, frankly. We invited them to the first conference on Christianity. They were so happy with what they saw, they offered us a special issue.
Oh,
so
great.
The papers got published. There are about 12 or 14 papers synthesized with abstracts, and they gave us a whole issue. When the issue came out and they found out about our doing the sequence around the world, they came back to us and said, would you consider allowing us to have a special issue on each of these traditions because we feel that they're underappreciated and really, frankly, not well known in our circles. So we were astounded. Obviously, it meant a lot more work, editorial work, but it did ramp up both the interest level and the commitment level, and we have had now, in each of these instances, some extraordinary papers that we have been able to bring forward so that, you know, a wider audience can see them, because the journals are obviously available not only in print but also online. They get wide circulation.
Boy, that is fantastic. What an incredible resource and inspiration for people. Well, I can't wait for your conference in June. That's going to be a really profound event.
Well, I was working on it all day yesterday. You know, these things take time. We only have 98 seats at Yale in the place we're going to do it. So we're very selective about the personalities that we invite so that we have a good diversity, obviously from all the traditions, but also of academic and practical people. We also are hoping to have a number of people from the media. Not that the conference will be on the record so much, but we'd like them to be able to report about what we're doing, you know, in a profound way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if you don't get the word out, then there's no conversation out in the world that talks about what.
And it's not meant to be a private conversation, so we want it to have legs and to have effect, and that's why the journals obviously circulate and why a conference of various sorts. In India, we had 350 people. They were literally, I mean, the IIM there is, there are nine of them in India, but it's a wonderful and, of course, important institution in India for training of MBAs. But it really turned out a large audience. I was asked to open the conference and give the C.K. Prahlad Memorial tribute.
Wow.
Of course, you know, and some of your listeners know that C.K. was at the Ross School of Business at Michigan, one of the most profound strategy thinkers probably of our times. He deceased and left us just a year and a half or two ago. And he had a big impact on companies where he did a lot of consultation, but his writings, you know, we could mention some of them, like Bottom of the Pyramid most recently, but others, really did change management thinking. They were radical. But what most people didn't know about CK, not only was he Indian, but he came out of this very, very rich Brahmin Hindu tradition, and it really colored a lot of his thinking.
I heard him speak once, and you know, I didn't know anything about his spiritual background, but just his presence felt so spiritual, and there was so much wisdom in everything he said. So I can see where that came from. Well, I have just a couple more questions for you before we open the line for people to ask you questions as well. You know, now we're in the midst of the Democratic Convention and had the Republican Convention last week. And, you know, we're talking about practical wisdom for the workplace, but that's embedded in society, and the corporate world is embedded in the society we find ourselves in right now, which is so polarized, or it seems to be to me in what I see in the media. What's your take on that, and what is the role of spiritual and religious wisdom? You know, we talked about building a bridge. Do you see a way that a bridge can be built in where we are now and where we need to go as a country?
Well, Nick Capaldi, who's a philosopher from a Catholic perspective at Loyola University, and I have just finished writing a book that touches on some of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book on America's spiritual capital, so it looks backward about how America was formed and past generations, how those ideas were brought forward, and how that legacy is in some ways either alive or ill today. So I'm quite interested in that. And you know, in my life, I have been part of the political milieu, having worked in the U.S. State Department and then on the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee and as an appointee in the United Nations for at least one administration. I have actually a very strong bipartisan foreign policy background, and I think that's essential to Americans and America. But this matter of polarization is something that I think does plague us, and it can lead to a spiral downward. So we need to find ways to not only bridge our differences, to make compromises, which is a political act, but to have a civil conversation in society. Politics is obviously part of society. And we were obviously talking in this conference about the corporation or the business unit in society. So I don't think businesses should be overly politicized. When they become politicized, they can become corrupted. There can be a kind of crony capitalism. I don't think the state knows best which enterprises should succeed or which should fail. I'd prefer to leave that to markets and to excellence. But these are all issues that are certainly surrounding us in this political season as we look ahead to November and what looks like an extremely close election. I spend a lot of my time traveling around the world, not only with the conferences I just mentioned, but speaking in different places and writing case studies. I've always done that. I've been an advocate of globalization for, well, it seems like a lifetime. And it is the case that the rest of the world still looks to America. There is very keen interest in our soft power, in our cultural power. Needless to say, we have great military power. We have extraordinary economic power. But the rest of the world really still looks to America. And who leads us and how we conduct ourselves and which ideas are prominent makes a huge difference, I think, at this point in world history. There are all kinds of theories about China coming next or different regions of the world's emerging, and I think some of that may or may not be true, but it is the case that America still, well, to use Lincoln's phrase, maybe the last best hope for mankind. So the interest in America, in the American economy, in American corporate governance, in American legal systems, and then, of course, in our leading corporations, is really significant everywhere you go in the world.
So if you had a crystal ball and you could look ahead 2 or 3 years from now, do you think we will have found a way to bridge the gap and move forward more collaboratively? Or do you think, I mean, what's your sense of it?
Well, I think politically we are at a kind of stalemate, and some of that has to do with gridlock, where different parts of our system are controlled by different political parties. So there's, you know, the likelihood that some of that will continue, you know, depending on who wins the election. I think it's essential, though, both for our economic prosperity and for global commerce, that there be, a more unanimous vote, a more sane kind of conversation in the United States. Because, as I was saying, the rest of the world is looking to that, and it still looks to American leadership. I don't think that the American century is behind us. We're still in a position of some commanding heights, and we have leadership not only for our own 50 states, but for international organizations and for the global economy. So much of what we do depends on the global economy today, with the trade flows and investment flows as they are and as they've developed, that we don't want to crimp that. We don't want to throw sand in those mechanisms. We want them to continue and actually to expand. So that should be one of the most important things on the medium term. You said 3 years, 5 years horizon. And there are obviously different ways policy-wise to do that. But one way I would hope is to have this conversation between different cultures. Some people, pundits, have said there was an inevitable clash of cultures. I don't accept that. I mean, there can certainly be civilizational discord, and there can be even wars, but it's incumbent on us, and those of us who know better, to work at the edges here and to try to continue that work so that we can understand each other better, that commerce can grow. And one way to do that is this deep-rooted way to understand the spiritual origins of the human community.
It's like our shared
and its
capital.
Richness. And its richness. Yeah, so I have, maybe your second question I'm getting into is like I've developed this concept with some others about spiritual capital that we hope to talk about at least to some degree at the conference coming up later in October.
Yeah, so you want to say a little bit about it right now to whet people's appetite?
Well, spiritual capital is something that I guess is a fairly new 10-year-old term in the social sciences. It has some parallels and similarities to other forms of capital. So obviously everyone knows about financial capital because you carry it around in your wallet and it takes various forms. Everyone knows about intellectual property and intellectual capital because of patents and the importance of technology. Most people have come in the last decades to understand that human betterment, particularly through education and the kinds of conferences we've all been part of, has to do with our human capital. Some places in the world lag behind on human capital. Some genders lag behind maybe on the development of human capital. That's a question we could beg. But this notion of social capital has come largely through the writings of Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam forward about the networks of trust, the arc of trust that we live in that make life possible. So that's important for civil life. It's important for our cultural conversations. It's important, obviously, in nations and neighborhoods. but lots of authors have talked about social capital in the context of companies, of corporate cultures, which is just another form of culture. Organizations have cultures. Companies have cultures. They might be in the same industry, in the same business, but they're very different. And those cultures then determine their success and how they're run, whether they're good places to work or places you want to leave and go down the elevator shaft as quickly as possible. What I'm arguing is that about half, in our empirical research, of all social capital originates out of a social, out of a spiritual orientation. So if we look at the founding of universities, the founding of hospitals, the founding of voluntary associations, the foundings of all kinds of clubs, of every kind of civic association, in the modern world, so I'm not talking about something that's ancient here, that origin largely lies in our spiritual proclivities. And that's true within Christianity and Judaism, in Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism. And you can go down the list, even in the minor religions in the world. These have been major contributing factors to the way we have lived our lives and the institutions that we live in. So we shouldn't ignore them. We should respect them. We should look at the origins, and we could say, then, how does this spiritual capital affect who we are, how we live? And on the corporate level, back to our header here, how does that spirituality affect the places we work? Not just the workforce taking that spirituality to work, but I'm particularly interested in, and maybe that's the third question, I'm particularly interested in cases, that means business cases, hard cases, empirical cases, real things, ways in which different companies have been formed, strategies, visions, statements, right down to the way they're managed and execute their businesses from these different spiritual traditions. And it's really a fascinating domain that has been understudied, and I think we can learn a lot about economic life, about religious practice, and particularly about practical wisdom for management when we do that.
And that's, we should mention www.doingvirtuousbusiness.com so that people can see some of the case studies on video, just little clips of the.
Yes,
you,
you
go
always
much
have
more
to popularize
depth.
What you yeah. do. And PBS was generous with us. Well, we raised money to make a PBS documentary by that title. And then the website, which allows people to look at shorter clips. In that particular film, we looked at 14 different companies and filmed them over the course of a year from different traditions. My work at Yale, if I can talk about it for a minute, where we have a very large, I could say Templeton Foundation-funded research grant for 3 years, has brought together, thanks to that grant and four different postdoctoral researchers that have worked with me, 25 new case studies from seven different spiritual traditions, including the philosophical tradition of humanism, so not all of them religious, looking at this notion of how the spiritual capital actually affects large global companies. This is material that, again, has never been presented, and these cases are very new. They're very fresh. They're done in the Yale School of Management template. They're all done on web pages and very, very robust with lots of videos and clips and links to other websites, but they tell very powerful stories. And they're very, very diverse.
And are those publicly accessible? How will people see them?
It will be. It's behind a firewall in part now. Mm-hmm. Some of the cases experimentally are available at www.yalespiritualcapital.edu. But the very good news is that Emerald Publishing, the big UK European publisher of textbooks, has signed us to take on all 25 cases. So they're being published, actually, they'll be out next January, so not that long from now, in a textbook with that kind of title, and it will be available both in hard copy and, as most people use things today, online. And we're busy right now writing the teaching notes that go with each of the cases. So the idea is that no one can say any longer, which may have been the case hitherto, well, there are no cases to teach, or I don't know anything about Whole Foods or, Tata sounds like an interesting company, but how would you teach it? Now the cases exist, and the teaching notes will help the professors, both at the undergraduate and at the MBA level. And I actually think that some of this material will be highly relevant to companies themselves in various forms of custom education and executive education if they want to get at these kinds of materials. So it's not heavy theoretical material. It's case material. It's very readable, and it is vibrant in terms of the technology and the use of video linkages. So that I know I've experimented with my MBA students at Yale, and they really love these cases.
What a difference that's going to make. I think of it, too, in terms of business leaders, not only the students. Of course, it's so rich for them, and they're the leaders of the future. But business leaders, many of them do feel this spiritual calling, this spiritual vocation, and don't think it's possible. They don't. It's just like, well, that just won't work in the real world. But when
who's
you
doing it, or I'm at a loss because I would be criticized if I had even such notions. Well, it's not so foreign. It exists all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
It exists in different traditions. So we can't just look at one and say somehow somebody has a monopoly on it. And it's so rich and so interesting. Well, I guess I'm enthusiastic, but you just have an appetite for it.
Yeah. Well, and so if someone does feel that calling, they see that there's these 25 cases. They can then go and read ones that either fit their spiritual tradition or their industry or their part of the world or whatever they need to feel anchored in it and get practical examples of what to do.
They can learn about the DNA that made these companies possible, and all of them struggle. So,
yeah.
I mean, some people joke and say these are perfect companies or virtuous companies. Hardly the case. They've all had failures. They've all had problems.
Just like human beings.
Just like human beings. And they practice different virtues, I would argue, but they do it to different extents and different levels. And they're really fascinating because you're seeing a richness that that business really is. It is a moral science. It is an art of that sort. And I think they're also very, at least I'm told, inspirational. I find that students read them, and they're not all extremely large companies, but I have to admit that I am biased towards large, publicly traded, significant global companies because I'm trying to make a point.
Yes.
But some of them are newer, emerging, smaller scale companies. We're just writing a case right now because one of my students wanted to write the case, and we decided to write it because they brought it to our attention of a new business model, and that's Tom's Shoes, which I'm sure listeners are familiar with. And we're
the whole
just
idea
finished
of social
writing
entrepreneurship.
That case. Yes, so we have a case of that
that
ilk.
Mm-hmm.
We are just finishing a case as well, which is a very big case on Islamic finance, and the leading proponent of that in Kuwait, a Kuwaiti bank. Again, most Western students, I find, don't know the first thing about Islam. They have a very prejudiced view, if they have a view at all. And they need to understand these traditions and
they'll
the
be doing
real
business
institutions
there.
That are anchored in them.
Yeah. Well, I do want to open it up. So one more quick question, just with asking for a short answer. What are you looking forward to most at the Wisdom at Work conference?
Well, I think the conference brings together a wide variety of people. So I'm looking forward to the richness of the conversation, seeing some old friends, surely.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some in Northwest Arkansas, as you know.
Yes.
But I really go to such conferences to learn new things and to meet new people. And I'm absolutely certain that will happen. And some of that is very spontaneous. It's not planned.
Yeah, it happens in the hallways on the breaks.
Yeah,
great. Well, let's open it up now to any questions or comments from people on the call. Just say your name and introduce yourself to Ted.
Well, this is Peggy. I'm curious if you could share a type of conversation that has occurred at some of these conferences when you bring the religious people with the corporate people. Can you give an example of what they're talking about, how the conversation goes.
Well, in the six conferences that I mentioned in this series, they're fairly tightly organized. So they're not. I go to a lot of conferences where there's rich dialogue, and some of it is unplanned, and people speak their minds. In this case, we have papers, or presentations that catalyze a conversation. So it's a bit more formal than just getting together around a round table. It's a different style. And the presentations, for the most part, have been excellent. What I have found interesting is, because I live in both worlds, I live in the academic world at Yale, and I live in the practical real world. I've been in business. I still have a consulting strategy practice, so I'm in companies every week. What I have found most interesting is the conversation that I find rarely takes place any longer between people from the one domain, the academic domain, and the business domain. So bringing those two groups together, oftentimes they don't speak the same language. They're suspicious of each other. They are fairly wary in the first instance. But then they learn that there's something really to be gained in that conversation. And I've actually witnessed that firsthand. And it's rather exciting when it happens.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Portia, and I have a question about a book that Judy had mentioned to us in a recent email that you've written called Doing Virtuous Business.
Yes.
Which I fully intend to check out. But my initial question is, how do you define virtue? And I'm going to put myself on mute because I have a contractor here, so I'll just listen.
Well, hopefully it's a good contractor. So I start this book with the kind of ancient definitions of virtue that grow up out of the Greek traditions and bring them forward into the Christian centuries and into modernity. So I'm very much attuned to the philosophy of ethic, virtue ethics. So that's my orientation. It's not a relativist argument. It's not a situational argument. It's not a dogmatic one from one philosophical school or another, but it comes out of this tradition of virtue ethics. And I end up arguing that this discussion about virtue, which was part of the past, and it's resurfacing again, I guess, over the last 20 or 30 years, certainly in academic circles and in ethical circles, is making its way now back into our corporate life. And God knows we need it, because we are at a point, and now I'm going to give you the title of my next new book, where I think we have reached the end of ethics. I seriously believe, and I made this argument, the book will be published in about a year, that because of the financial collapse, because of the Ponzi schemes, because of all of the scandals, and we write about, frankly, all of them of recent vintage, that we are at a point in society, and particularly in corporate life, where there is really very little ethics left. So it's really critical for us to find a way to restore ethics in order to have better companies and better dealings with each other. So I think it's absolutely critical. But in doing virtuous business, I was looking at the positive side, what I call economic virtue, and we have a methodology for finding out which companies were, say, the best performers in which industries over which periods of time. And then we interviewed those companies and kicked the tires and talked to them, and we wrote about them, and then we organized that argument in a popular fashion around 14 different virtues that those companies exhibited. No company exhibited all 14. Some of them exhibited multiple virtues, but most of them that we looked at, and we looked at 60 different companies, exhibited one or two virtues in an extraordinary way. And that's what we set out to write about, tell stories about, and give empirical evidence on. So we wove that all together into this big argument about doing virtuous business. My new book is about the opposite. It's about economic vice, because, as I said, I don't really think any longer that there are just a few bad apples. There are just too many. And we really need to confront this new reality, which is a kind of very virile economic vice. And, of course, you combat that with the antidote of economic virtue. So the two, in fact, go hand in hand.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. It gives me something to look forward to.
It's also kind of a depressing remark to say the end of virtue, the end of ethics. You really think it's that bad, Ted?
Well, I used to think, you know, that the cup was more than half full.
Yeah, that's kind of the way I'm.
And
I'm,
you know, I have that kind
optimistic.
Of optimism, as you know.
Yeah.
But the reality is it's actually too abundant. So that I use the analogy, see if this works, that in the world of athletics, particularly professional athletics, we have a phenomenon, not just in bicycling or baseball, but in other sports, of doping.
Yeah, it's
and it's not an inconsequential one or a small one. It's everywhere. People say 85% of baseball players use some kind of steroids. Obviously, in cycling, you've seen, you know, major athletes stripped of medals, and even in the Olympics, I was just at the Olympics. People were stripped of awards and medals they had won because they took this great risk. But the risk, I guess they say, is not so great because I want to win so much that I'm willing to take that risk. What we have done in our business life is something similar. We have abandoned ethics, and we've taken on all these other risks. I call them financial temptations, and I list them by different economic vice-like names. And we've been willing to, you know, cheat on our financial statements, involve ourselves in Ponzi schemes, you know, take over companies illegitimately, make up false information, do off-counting, off-balance sheet accounting. I mean, the list goes on and on. If I just mention names like Tyco and Enron and WorldCom, but then it just comes too rapidly now. It's not just Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. It's MF Global. It's Barclays and LIBOR. Every single week, it seems to me, in the last 3 or 4 years, we have this kind of episode. It's rampant. It's systemic.
It's like our trust in the corporate world, corporate leaders, as well as political leaders and religious leaders. The reputation is at the lowest level it's ever been.
It's at an all-time low. We did a Gallup poll a few years ago with George Gallup, and trust then was at 15%, which he said was at an all-time low, and it's only gone lower. And that includes categories, business, religious, and political. And without trust, it's very, very difficult to have civil society or to have commerce. So there's a lot at risk.
One of our other keynote speakers is Andre Del Beck. And
who I know,
He's a beautiful guy. And he says that the underlying vice of all of the vices is hubris. Do you talk about that at all?
Well, we talk about pride, which
is
the old-fashioned way of saying hubris, but they are the same thing. It's it's an arrogance that basically says I'm always right and no better and everything, and others know less and nothing. And that sin, to use a theological concept, gets people perennially into trouble. And I would say that leaders who have that kind of hubris, who don't practice humility, will inevitably have a downfall.
Maybe that's, you know, we're actually seeing more of the downfall because that's part of the spiritual lessons people need to learn.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So the cases we've written in this new book are very, very disturbing. I mean, you
I'm
know
not so
headlines.
Sure I want to read it. I'm going to get very depressed.
Well, I think, you know, I could make another movie and start the movie in each episode with the people that are in jail or should be in jail.
Yeah, they may actually have some things to say about what they've learned. I want to
but
take
it, that, you know, the back end of that is, not to be overly depressing, is that we have to find a way out. So we have to talk about how we as individuals, how we as units, how we as society, how we as corporations build the character, build the particularly corporate cultures and also the regulatory frameworks and put into place then the kind of fiduciary audits and other things, the controls that are necessary to have a more ethical corporation. And that work is hard work, and it needs to be done.
And so what you're saying is the practical part of that is dealing with what is. This is the way the world is right now.
It is.
You've got concrete evidence of that. And you also have concrete evidence that there's a spiritual underpinning to our society and to the organizations in their founding. And so your message is we need to get back to that in today's terms, in today's world, in a practical way.
Because
in order to
too
move
much
ahead.
Short-termism, mm-hmm. Which is another phrase, mm-hmm. will inevitably lead us into a darker and worse place. So we need to have longer-term perspectives. We need to have ethical practices, and we need to have better corporate governance. To name a few things, and a lot of that originates, frankly, with the character of the individual person. And as we say, oftentimes tone is set at the top of the leaders of these organizations.
Well, and in the America's Spiritual Capital, you talk about the connection to God or the divine, however someone might define that, as being a discipline that's beyond the disciplines of business, but that lead to that ethical character.
Correct.
That a sense of being committed to something greater than oneself.
Right.
And that's what we need to see more of in the world.
And that's why your conference and why IABIS is so excited about partnering on it, because it does carry that banner.
Yeah, well, we're going to have a wonderful time together and hopefully create new wisdom. One of my hopes for the conference is that by bringing together business leaders and academics and faith leaders, that there'll be enough dialogue about what's possible that people may want to do research projects together or create programs together or in some other way work collaboratively across disciplines. So we're hoping that the conference will be a laboratory for new work, new discussion. And
well,
I know you'll be a
certainly,
part.
It's not the case that this is one discipline or one perspective or mm-hmm. one nationality or one anything. This is our future, and it involves every dimension.
Yeah, we're all in it together. So, Vivian, I know you're on the call, and I want to check and see if you have a question before we close out the call, or if you have a comment of any kind.
No, I have so much to think about, though. I'm very excited, and I really can't wait to read the books.
Great. Glad to have you on the call. We got 5 more minutes to go, and I'd like to make a couple of announcements, and then I'm going to do another reading from your work, Ted, and I'll leave the very last comments to you. And so if you have any announcements or closing thoughts, Ted, those will be yours to make. Of course, everyone knows that the conference is going to be October 31st, November 1st. We also have 3 pre-conferences on October 30th, and we have a post-conference training session for people who want to be involved in the spiritual-based leadership research program. There'll be training on what that research is all about and what the protocols are for interviewing spiritual-based leaders. And so I think that's – oh, and then in terms of future teleconferences between now and then, I don't have them scheduled, but we are planning to invite Gilbert Lenson and Robert Wimé and André Delbecq to each be a guest the way Ted has been today, so that you get a chance to know a little bit more about them and engage in dialogue with them even before the conference. So, Ted, thank you so much again for being on the call and for the ongoing partnership that you and I have shared over the years and for the amazing, prolific work you're doing in the world. And I'd like to read this closing quote, and this comes from Spiritual Enterprises. The reaching out towards God through worship, prayer, devotion, and pious observance is a specific kind of discipline, which is not the discipline of human society. It involves an act of metaphysical submission. a bowing down of the whole spirit to a power that lies beyond the world of our perception. This posture of spiritual reception, where the individual opens his heart to an otherworldly form of obedience, is the core of piety, and it provides unique forms of practical knowledge. For example, the knowledge of what to do and how to behave in circumstances where the existing writ of social mores does not run, the knowledge of how to forgive someone who has tried to destroy you, the knowledge of how to ask forgiveness for your own recognized faults. It also begins with thankful praise and leads to humility and gratitude. As Max Dupree once said, the first and last word of leadership is thanks. It both sets the direction and motivates. And so the last word I want to say to you, Ted, today is thanks, and thanks to those of you who are on the call. You would like to make any closing comments, Ted?
No, I'm very encouraged by what you're doing and our partnership, and I'm looking forward to what we'll build together in the coming weeks and months here. I'm excited to be with you again.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Ted, and God bless you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.